Today, when we hear about a launch of a space shuttle, we tend to take it for granted. Not so with the first American missions in space. On this 30th anniversary of Apollo 11, is there anything we can learn from those first space missions? Stay tuned.
To me, space flight is an adventure. It's finding more and more about God's handiwork.
This is Science, Scripture, and Salvation, a Creation Radio Journal. Standing in for Chris O'Brien, I'm Mark Rashi.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running.
30 years ago, on July 16, 1969, Apollo 11 was launched. 4 days later, man was walking on the moon. And although it took just a small step for the astronauts, what brought them there were many steps by scientists and engineers who carefully planned and tested new ideas along the way. 5 years ago, the Institute for Creation Research produced a special broadcast to commemorate the 25th anniversary of this event. Today, we want to share with you some of the recordings from that broadcast of men involved in the Apollo space program. We'll get their perspective on the lessons learned from the early space program and Apollo 11. But first, what started the frenzy and race to space? Dr. Robert Lovell is a retired aerospace engineer. At the time of the space race, he was the senior design engineer of Convair Astronautics. They worked with NASA to develop the technology to reach the moon.
Probably one of the things that stimulated much of the thinking in the world, especially in the United States, was the fact that the Russians put up a Sputnik. And so it was after the Sputnik incident that this country became even more interested and active in pursuing rockets and missiles.
These rockets and missiles were the forerunners of manned flight in space.
My concern was primarily with those missions that involved the Atlas missile. The other missiles, we were aware of what was taking place. I was working for Convair, and they built the Atlas, and so that's where our energies were devoted. The Atlas missile was a product of General Dynamics, Convair, in San Diego. The rocket was 10 feet in diameter and stood 70 feet tall. And it was the rocket that was used for putting the first astronaut into orbit, along with numerous missions thereafter.
Prior to putting man in space, scientists had to do numerous studies to learn how to overcome any problems astronauts would face.
And the Atlas would launch satellites into orbit, which we referred to as being the SATAR. SATAR was an acronym for the particular experiments that they were conducting. And the satellites that were placed into orbit that could make all sorts of measurements concerning the radiation, the temperature, and on the basis of the information so learned, they were able to design a spacesuit. They were able to design equipment that would be necessary to protect the astronaut.
And this required a lot of imagination and ingenuity.
On a daily basis, we were asked to devise, invent, conceive things that had never been done before. You couldn't go to the library and find a book on the subject because since it had never been done before, there were no books. And in fact, we were the ones that were writing the book, and through the experimentation, trial and error, and just one's imagination, these things would be designed and they would be tested in the laboratory. And the test program that went along with this was extensive. Wherever we could, we tested these things to make sure that they would work in our environment, and then pray that the thing would work in the vacuum of space.
Each step was built upon the previous mission. Tom Henderson is now retired from NASA, but during the Apollo era, he worked with the mission simulators used for astronaut and flight control training.
The lunar program was announced after our first suborbital Mercury flight with Alan Shepard. Mercury was our first man-in-orbit accomplishment. The Gemini program, which was next, developed the orbital rendezvous techniques in Earth orbit, which would later be used in lunar orbit. The first manned Apollo mission was called Apollo 7. The next mission was a surprise to many. With just a few months before the mission, we decided to send Apollo 8 to the moon with the Saturn V rocket. Apollo 9, the next mission, was used to check out the lunar module in Earth orbit. Then Apollo 10 became sort of a preview flight for Apollo 11.
And this testing included training the astronauts. They had to endure grueling mental and physical training. Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke.
The Apollo 11 training was very similar to what we did. Physically, the training in the spacesuit was very tough. The Apollo spacesuit itself weighed about 55 pounds. We had a lightweight backpack that we wore in training, which was 95 pounds. The crews had basically three different areas of training. One was geological training. Then we had to learn the lunar surface experiments, activities, and how to operate in a spacesuit. And then the final training, and probably the most extensive, was, of course, to learn how to fly the spacecraft in the simulators.
And part of this training was in the mission simulators. Tom Henderson.
Mission simulators are used to develop and verify flight procedures, to train for various failures that can occur in spacecraft systems, to verify flight software. We have simulation computers which perform all the calculations to make all this work. And this allows the missions to be practiced realistically. And included with this is the ability to insert pre-selected system malfunctions so the crews can learn to evaluate and take action as to how to cope with those kind of failures.
Today, computers are used to generate the graphics to make simulators realistic. But during the training for the Apollo missions, engineers had to be a little more creative.
We actually had 1,000 ball bearings of various sizes depending on the brightness of the star embedded in a sphere, and the reflected light produced very realistic appearing stars. The Earth and lunar orbits were simulated using films, and then in between the Earth and the Moon we had various sized pictures of each of the Earth and the Moon.
And this prepared the astronauts for their missions into space.
The heart of the mission simulator really is the crew station, and the interior of the crew station provides an astronaut with an actual spacecraft environment. The result of this is he gets used to the spacecraft, and when he actually takes a flight, it's second nature because he's spent hundreds of hours in the simulator and it's been just the same.
Maury Minette was the simulation engineer during Apollo 11.
My job was to train Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to provide a habitable spacesuit and cabin atmosphere, and also conducted training exercises in the lunar module simulator. A primary area of emphasis in the simulator was malfunction recognition and recovery. The simulator offered really an ideal learning environment because the crew could make a mistake in recovering from malfunction and the consequences weren't catastrophic.
A vital aspect of the space missions was the help and interaction from those on Earth.
Okay, I just checked getting back up to that first step. It's not even collapsed too far, but it's adequate to get back up.
Roger, we copy.
That's a pretty good little job.
Maury Minette.
When I was a kid, I read a lot of science fiction growing up. It's probably a major reason why I jumped at the opportunity to work for NASA. And one of the biggest surprises to me as part of the first moon landing was what an inaccurate picture science fiction writers had portrayed for the event. The scenario was of the lone test pilot who would perform his mission with very little assistance from the Earth other than voice communication. In actuality, on Apollo 11, in addition to voice, the lunar module sent back telemetry data that allowed every aspect of the vehicle performance to be monitored in real time. The amount and depth of this telemetry data would have just overwhelmed the crew if they had been required to interpret it. During the descent to the surface, the lunar module computer had an alarm that could have caused the termination of the descent and initiation to return to orbit. However, because we had these system experts in Houston that had another level of insight into the cause of the alarm, they were able to tell Armstrong that it was acceptable to proceed with the landing.
Charles Duke.
During the Apollo 11 flight, I had participated in helping the crew develop the lunar module checkout procedures and activation and power-up procedures and the descent procedures for the landing on the moon. So during the actual flight, I was the capsule communicator, or CAPCOM we called it, in mission control. And so during the descent, I was the voice of mission control, if you will, talking to the crew and relaying them information that we had that would help them in their descent. And I was very pleased and proud to have participated in such a historic mission in such a real way.
And it's important to note that the Apollo missions didn't happen by chance. It was hundreds of people working together to accomplish a purpose. The Apollo 11 astronauts said it this way the night before they returned to Earth.
This operation is somewhat like the periscope of a submarine. All you see is the three of us, but beneath the surface are thousands and thousands of others. To all those, I would like to say thank you very much.
Tom Henderson.
As best as we knew how, nothing was left to chance. NASA and its associated contractors worked diligently to anticipate anything that could go wrong and to have, wherever possible, appropriate contingency actions available to recover from those failures.
And all this planning on the part of man really gives us insight into the origin of the universe and the one who created it.
To me, spaceflight is an adventure. It's finding more and more about God's handiwork. And I'm not afraid of what the results will be. I think ultimately the findings of science must honor God, who is the creator. For instance, Apollo spacecraft program manager George Lowe, as he described the complexity of the Apollo spacecraft, he said they were two machines, 10 tons of aluminum, steel, copper, titanium, and synthetic materials, 33 tons of propellant, 4 million parts, 40 miles of wire, 100,000 drawings, 26 subsystems, 678 switches, and 410 circuit breakers. To me, this is a vast complexity of engineering design. This complexity wasn't the result of a cosmic accident. It was a result of thousands of man-years of engineering work. It appears to me that a person is much more complex than the Apollo spacecraft. So it makes sense to believe that I am the result of a designer, an all-powerful God who has a plan for my life and to whom I am subject. Therefore, unashamedly, I have placed my trust, my faith, in the Lord Jesus Christ alone. Jesus, I feel, is God who became man so he could die on the cross to pay for my sins. Then he rose from the dead to assure my salvation. Praise his name.
We hope you've enjoyed today's program commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission, and we would like to thank NASA for providing our special audio. We hope you've enjoyed today's program commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission. We invite you to tune in next week as we look at the other lessons from these space missions. If you'd like more information about Creation or ICR's ministry, we'd like to send you a free information packet. Please request the free info pack when you contact us.